Session number 15474, reel 1.
Mr. Jones, reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Liverpool, on a notable date, really, 1st of January, 1920.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a railway man, railway carriage examiner, man who walks along with taps the wheels, you know, among other things.
Did you go to school in Liverpool?
Yes, I did, yes.
Mm. How old were you when you left school?
When I actually left school, I was 13. I left at 14, but as my birthday is on the 1st of January, I didn't go back after the Christmas term. No secondary education at all.
Did you get a job?
Yes, I worked from the age of 14 until the outbreak of war on the Liverpool Cotton Exchange, for a firm on the Liverpool Cotton Exchange.
Were you doing that when war broke out?
Yes, I was. I was in the territory. I had joined the territorials after the Munich crisis, of course. And so I was mobilized straight away, actually.
Why had you decided to join the territorials?
The inevitability of conscription was, well, it was certain. And I felt that if I joined the territorials, I'd be among people that I knew. I'd have a choice of where I was going, what branch of the service, what unit I was going to be in, rather than take potluck on where somebody put me if I was conscripted.
Which year was it you joined the TA?
In 1939, yeah, early in 1939.
And which unit did you join?
The 66th Anti-Tank Regiment. Royal Artillery, of course, that is.
What was the character of the training you had with them?
Pretty deplorable, really, because it was a brand new regiment and they had hardly any people with prior experience. We were all joining up a new regiment, and if it were not for the fact that a few reservists had joined, there would have been absolute paucity of training. We had no equipment. For a long time we had no uniforms. We had no drill hall. In fact, we were recruited in a new shop premises which hadn't been let. And that's where medical examinations were carried out. And across the road was a field in which we did our training, which was really square bashing training. We had no equipment, no rifles, no guns.
So you wouldn't have been a great deal of use against tanks?
Hopeless. Hopeless. In fact, the first time we saw a gun was when we went to camp on August the 20th and we went to South Wales, Gower Peninsula, and there we had a wonderful fortnight of training, actually, on guns. We thought it was gun drill and a lot about the gun itself.
What anti-tank weapons were they?
The two-pounder, which, as you know, was a wonderful piece of engineering, but totally inadequate, it proved to be when the war really started in France, in the lowlands in 1940, against the German armour.
Why was it such a wonderful piece of engineering?
Because it was finished so beautifully. I'm drawing now comparison with the later supplied six-pounders from America, where you cut your fingers with unsmoothed welding, and whereas the two-pounder was smooth in every way. It had, when taken off its wheels, it had a 360-degree traverse, which you could whiz round in seconds, do a total circuit in seconds. And the whole thing about it, the sights with protective rubber cushioning against the recoil, it was really smooth, is the word. Mm.
Did you hear Chamberlain's declaration of war?
Yes, I didn't actually hear it. I was travelling on that particular moment. I was travelling in a vehicle from camp into Swansea. It was a Sunday, of course, for relaxation. But we knew it was imminent, of course. We knew it was imminent. And we knew we travelled in that vehicle into Swansea, that it had happened, because whereas the population of the people we would see on our route would pay no attention to us, you could see from the greetings that people were making that there was a significant change in people's attitude. We were already not exactly heroes, but we were down sight more important than we were the day before.
How did you feel about the war declaration yourself?
I felt that, thank God, you know, it's here. There's something, we're going to do something about this, because we all thought, I certainly did, that our stock was pretty low after Munich, and that we were going to go on giving way to these threats all the time. And we, even up to the time of the declaration, we thought that, what is so different about Poland, another place we didn't know, a long way from us that we didn't know, from Czechoslovakia that we'd given away pretty well, or sold down the river, is the expression, I think, the year before. So, yes, there was a joy, there was an absolute pleasure to think that we were likely to be doing something at last about this menace.
What happened to you next?
The War Office obviously had got lots of things on its mind, and they didn't know quite what to do with us, so they left us at Swansea for 3 or 4 days after September the 3rd. We were due back on September the 3rd, actually. That was the date when the camp finished. This is why I call that period of my life the longest fortnight, because we went away for a fortnight on the 20th of August, and that lasted 7 years. And they kept us there for whilst they were looking for billets for us nearer home, which they did, and I suppose it would be about the 7th or 8th of September when we moved back again to Liverpool, and they put us into the golf clubhouses at Crosby, which is near where the regiment was formed in Liverpool suburbs.
How did you spend the period of the so-called phony war?
We stayed at Crosby, and then moved over to the Whittle Peninsula, and I suppose that covers the whole of that period. When we did, even then, didn't have any two-pounders, but that was understandable because they wanted every bit they've got probably over in France. We did get uniforms just before camp, but these were the old service dress uniforms, because battle dress was not available to us then. What battle dress they had, I presume, was going to the people that had been sent right away over to the continent. And indeed, they never did recall those service dress uniforms for about 2 years while we were in this country. And this meant there's all those buttons and things to polish every day, because anyone could call a service dress a parade at any time. We got rifles at Crosby, and we did gun drill on imaginary guns. Just purely from the memory of what we'd seen at Gower, in this permanent camp on the Gower Peninsula, at camp. It became quite farcical, actually, because to an officer who was watching a gun drill who said, "I didn't see you unlock that wheel before you took it off," you could argue, "Well, yes, I did." And so they devised a system whereby everyone that was doing any task in gun drill had to shout out what he was doing. And this became bedlam, especially if you've got four gun crews in a row. with everyone shouting their heads off about I'm now unlocking this wheel, and it became quite funny really, because even when you were raising the trail leg, it was like making all these noises in sympathy with the task it was supposed to be doing.
Did it surprise you that nothing much was happening in the war from the army point of view?
Yes, it did surprise us, because when you hear that the war has been declared, and it has been declared to help Poland, and nothing is being done about helping Poland at all, you wonder when it's all going to happen. And even then you began to think, well, perhaps somebody will start talking again soon, and the whole thing will be called off. It wasn't really until the war really broke out, the phony war ended, and the war broke out in earnest when they invaded the lowlands, that you realised, yes, well, it is now. It has started now. Because even air raids hadn't really properly started then.
I think you had a spell guarding internees.
Oh yes, that was an interesting exercise, that was. Because the 18B regulation was a highly unpopular, controversial thing here, because here we were putting people, arresting people, because of their nationality, and let's face it, a lot of these people were refugees from Nazi Germany who probably suffered more from Germany than we ever would. But nevertheless, they had to be. Once Italy came into the war, and there was an awful lot of Italians here, something had to be done about that. But we guarded this camp at Huyten. Huyten was the first place that they used, because it was so convenient, being a newly finished housing estate in Liverpool suburbs that hadn't been rented out to anybody at all, which they could conveniently enclose and yet not in prison, if you see what I mean. It was a nice balance. And I think that there was a general reciprocal understanding of each other's position. That we, the guards, had a job to do, which was unpleasant. Arduous, too, because we were on 24-hour guard every other day. And we understood a lot of that there could be a lot of people among those in there who should not be there.
Were there any of the guards who weren't very understanding, who were hostile?
Oh, no, I don't think so. The other thing about that was that here was another station that we were at, which wasn't very far from home. And this meant that people could get home easily. And we knew that wasn't always going to apply. So there was a certain consolation in being a Titan as well, being a Liverpool regiment.
What conditions were they being kept under?
Well, I think they couldn't have been better. All these houses were new. They were all unfurnished. Admittedly, that there were no beds it was pathetic, really, to see people who could well be doctors, brilliant musicians, we know that they were now, but having to fill palliasses with straw to bed down in these places. But I think that they probably acknowledged that things could have been worse. They were enclosed, but they weren't imprisoned.
Did you have any conversations with any of the internees?
Yes. It wasn't easy, because when you were guarding the camp, we were in turrets. I think it would be about 12 around the whole perimeter of this place. But there wasn't very much contact. Wasn't much chance of contact at all, really, because they're, you know, about 12 foot below you anyway.
Do you remember any words that passed between yourself and...
No, no, I don't. No, I can't say that at all. But that, there was one extraordinarily amusing incident, if you'd excuse my talking about a disability. We had a chap who had a stutter, and he used to have to shout all through the night, you know, number one post, number two post, all's well. And this chap on this particular night, I remember well, he shouted number one and started to stutter. And this went on every quarter of an hour through the night. And anyone that was in these houses around the perimeter, then must have been, it must have been a torment until they got absolutely used to it, like you do with all regular noises. But the one on this particular night where this poor chap couldn't get out the words, an Italian head poked out of the window and said, number two post to number three post, all as well, you know, for him.
Did the internee seem disgruntled or philosophical?
Well, I find it difficult to answer that now because I've read a lot on the subject and I know a lot were disgruntled. But I wouldn't say that was patent at the time.
Did you personally, what was your personal attitude towards the policy of...
Oh, I thought it was right. Once Italy had come into the war, we'd heard about fellow travellers and that, and we suspected all foreigners.
Was it only Italians you were looking after?
No, Germans. And I imagine other nationalities, I just don't know.
Any other incidents you remember?
No, not from that case, not from that brief spell.
Now, after this, what happened to you?
Dunkirk was imminent then, and
I think actually this was just after.
That's right. That's
Dunkirk.
Right. That was after Dunkirk. That's right. We came from Rugeley to there. That's right. Rugeley, and from Huyton, we went, I think, down to the Suffolk coast, and we were then defending the Suffolk coast with 2-pounders, which had been supplied. We then had some vehicles, and we also were trained in some ancient 3-inch naval guns, which were placed at various places from Shotley, I think, right up to Southwold or somewhere like that on the coast. And we had this base camp. Excuse me. Yes, I became a driver then. I learned to drive then, and so I was on the base camp at Heveningham Hall, just by Halesworth. And I had all these supply runs to do to all the gun positions. Could be anywhere. I there was a certain jinx about me too, because whenever I took the quartermaster sergeant with rations and pay and mail to Shotley, we used the road which went across Martlesham Aerodrome, which is a you know, Battle of Britain fighter drone, and every time I took him across there, the aerodrome would be bombed. And the relief, the alternate driver, every time he took him across, it wasn't bombed. So I became a bit of a jinx until the quartermaster, who was a married man with a couple of kids, decided that he'd rather not go with me. I've taken off that run. There was one really bad raid in, I think it was August the 15th, when quite a number of people were killed and a few aircraft destroyed at Martlesham.
Did you see that one?
Yes, oh yes, we were belting across the Air Force as the aerodrome as this happened, yes.
What exactly did you see?
Well, I saw men and girls scuttling for shelter. I saw bombs drop on the airfield. I didn't actually see any buildings damaged. In fact, I was so busy driving to get out of the bombing area that I didn't see very much.
It was a frightening experience?
Frightening, yes, but you must understand too that at that age and at that stage of the war, there was a certain sort of bravado about having seen something of it, at least, you know, being part of it at last.
Were any of the attackers brought down?
No, no.
Any other sights that you saw of the Battle of Britain, because you were there in July, August?
Oh, the dogfights, of course, or the daily dogfights you saw.
Did you personally think at that time that the Germans would invade?
Oh, yes. Yes, I was rather surprised. I saw one day, and this was the signal for my change of attitude. I was at a station just after my base camp days at Heveningham. I was sent on a gun sight to Bordsey, which is right opposite to Felixstowe, the other side of the river. And the guns were about 200 yards in from the beach. And I saw an explosion in front of me one day and bits of debris flying around. And it transpired that engineers laying a mine there had accidentally sent one off. And the bits, what I thought were debris, were bits of a person actually blowing himself off. And I suddenly realized, my God, if they're mining here up at Felixstowe, there's a hell of a lot of coastline where they think that invasion could come.
Did you think the Germans would succeed in defeating us if they got across?
No, I don't think we ever thought that. I don't think we ever thought that. We always talked of what we were going to do when this lot was over. But never in that reasoning was the thought of defeat, even at the worst possible time, ever countenanced at all.
How much effect did Churchill's broadcasts have on you?
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. His inspiration and his determination was certainly reflected right through the units. You couldn't envisage how things could be without him.
What about Lord Haw Haw? Did you listen to him?
No, I never actually heard Lord Haw Haw. I only ever heard of what his outpourings were, you know, but snatches of that.
Mm. Why had you not heard him?
No, radio mainly. Mm. Radios were rare things to come across. I mean, I'm a jazz buff and American popular song thing. And if ever we got near a radio, then it was a delight which would be remembered. Also, of course, remember that there were no such things as transistors in those days. A radio had to have batteries.
What did you think of the coastal defences in Suffolk at that time?
Well, I thought that we were nicely covered, actually. later on, when I got down to Pevensey Bay, I realized how inadequate they were, but because, by comparison, I mean, because Pevensey Bay was really very well covered. The south coast really was very well covered. And there, in Suffolk, there were no such things as landing barriers in the at the sea. The only defense was guns and mines, obviously.
Any other incidents before we leave the Suffolk coast?
I can't think of anything outstanding. No.
How was it that you transferred from Suffolk to Sussex?
Well, I think there was a spell in between when we went to the Cotswolds, wasn't there?
Yes.
That was a cross-country move, the wisdom of which I didn't understand. I presume, really, it was to bring people in reserves to swap over so that you had a bit of a spell from the vigilance of guarding the coast. But yes, we had this spell in the Cotswolds, which was very enjoyable. In fact, my service at that point was nothing but enjoyment, hardly hedonism, but it was unreal, absolutely unreal.
And then you did another spell at Pevensey Bay?
Then, yes, down to Pevensey Bay. There again, my duties were mainly driving, and I drove the troop commander around the gun sites at all sorts of hours and to do nothing regular, you understand, just to make sure that everyone was vigilant at any time of night or day. But I did my turn on guard as well, so sleep was at a premium when I was down at Pevensey.
You suggested before that the defences in Sussex
were good. Mm. Yes, I think they were. I think they were good in the sense that we had guns actually on the beach around Pevensey, and then we had these other guns in reserve deeper back. So that I felt that there was more strength in depth on the south coast, and there's no doubt that we really did expect invasion. I think people. Until we got to the coast, people would tend to treat rather lightly guard duties. But when we got down to the coast, people knew that you had to guard. You had to be on your guard.
Were there any enemy attacks?
There was one attack on Eastbourne. As you know, Pevensey is right next to Eastbourne, and there were a few. Most of the bombers we saw were going over to London, obviously, at Pevensey. But there were a few daylight raids where people would just come over low flying and drop a few bombs in places like Eastbourne and Bexhill and Hastings. And there's one particular day, this thing came tootling, a Junkers 88. Came tootling over and made several runs over Eastbourne.